Big show to kick off Thanksgiving week on Monday, November 25th. Former GOP State Senator Len Susio dropped by with new numbers regarding the early release program for Connecticut inmates and the recidivism rate connected to that program. Lance LaRusso stopped by again at the 4 o'clock hour. We had a return visit from Lance, who's a former law enforcement officer, current attorney, media pundit on all things law enforcement, and we discussed current trends that the men and women of law enforcement are facing in the media and from the political class. And Joe Scully capped off the show in the 5 o'clock hour. Joe runs the Motor Transport Association of Connecticut, and he gave us his thoughts on the Democrats reverting back to a plan to impose tolls on trucks only.
You're listening to Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli on WICC 600.
Yeah, hi there. That's us. How are you? At coming up to 8 past 3 o'clock, 308, hour number 2 of our get-together right here on Connecticut Today. The number, as always, you want to get a question in or 2203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Coming up next hour, the 4 o'clock hour, former police officer, current author on all things crime and policing, Lance LaRusso, joins us in the 5 o'clock hour. Return visit from our buddy Joe Scully, who heads the Motor Transport Association of Connecticut, regarding the state's truckers. That's the group that represents the state's private truckers, small and large, regarding what we may be back to. Is this trucks-only toll thing again? So we'll talk about that coming up next hour. But now till 3:30, welcoming back another one of our regulars who kind of keeps an eye on things in Hartford on several fronts, including criminal justice. Former Republican State Senator Len Susio is with us. Len, how are you?
I'm doing great, Paul. I'm looking forward to a good big turkey, delicious turkey on Thanksgiving Day, 4 days from now.
Have you done have you done all your shopping as well?
All but the turkey. I got to pick that one up in the next day or so. Not much of a shopper. But you know what? I always do the food shopping for our family. My wife says it's part of my hunter-gatherer instinct.
Well, yes. Yeah, because Len, Aaron, and I have talked about this on the show. We go in, Len, we get what we want. We don't meander around the store, and we bring it out, mm-hmm. right? Right?
Yeah, no, that's it. I know what I want. I know where to look for it, and I know where the best deals are.
We don't go around going, "Oh, look at this! Let's look at this." No, that's not what that's not what guys do. Len, I wanted to have you on because I saw your Facebook post regarding the op-ed that you wrote yesterday that appeared in the Meriden Record Journal. I've taken the link, and folks, you can read it now. It's at the WICC 600 Facebook page, as will the audio of this interview be as soon as Aaron posts it after the show today. Len, you've made a habit, thankfully, of watching the numbers that are connected to the state's early release prison program. And on Sunday's editorial that, again, I posted here at our Facebook page, you have some pretty startling totals for us. What were you able to find out?
Yeah, I'd say startling is an understatement. Probably more like scandalous is more like it. The numbers are just shocking, startling, scandalous. There's been about 44,000 inmates that were discharged from prison early, having received these early release credits. And because I have an ongoing agreement pursuant to the Freedom of Information Act with the Department of Correction, every 6 months they provide me with a massive database, and I can go through that and see what for every inmate in Connecticut, who's been discharged and have they been readmitted to prison and did they get these early release credits. And what I found was that the inmates who had been discharged early have committed over 16,000, nearly 17,000 violent crimes after they were discharged early, having participated in what's called the risk reduction program that's supposedly going to improve their antisocial behavior. And I'm not counting, Paul, I want to emphasize, I'm not counting the technical violations of parole or probation. I'm talking about the violent crimes that have been committed by these thugs and these villains that have been let loose. And we're counting on murder, rape, various assaults of all kinds, armed robbery, you name it. It's all kinds of crimes have been committed. And it's stunning when you compute it on a daily basis, you can see that it's one violent crime more than six violent crimes are being committed each and every day for the last 8 years by a so-called rehabilitated criminal that's been let loose early on the streets, courtesy of our early release program. And when you look at the sexual assaults, the rapes, and the murders have been committed, it's one rape or murder every 7.8 days.
Len, you have been following this for a while, and this project was heartily championed by former Governor Governor Malloy and also Michael Lawler, who was his criminal justice czar. I know that they and other critics of you and other supporters of the program say, well, you know, letting criminals out for good behavior isn't anything out of the ordinary. It's a plan, a program that other states use. What's your reaction to all that when people say you're continuing to make a mountain out of a molehill here?
Well, first of all, there was a big federal study done by the federal Department of Justice, on hundreds of thousands of criminals, 400,000 that were let loose from prison in 2005. And they found that after 8 years or 9 years, 83% of them were readmitted for having committed another crime. And when you look at Connecticut's results, it's very close to that same result. So we're looking at saying, well, number one, the recidivism hasn't changed that much, maybe a slight tad. But again, we know for sure that it's failed in this state in a violent way for over 16,000 crimes that people were victimized by. And so for every single one of those poor victims, a woman who was raped or some person who was murdered or violently assaulted, it's 100% failure rate because they were assaulted by someone who was supposedly rehabilitated and obviously wasn't. And what's even more shocking to me, Paul, and I pointed this out in the op-ed piece, was there was a bill in front of the legislature this year, House Bill 5527, an act excluding persons convicted of certain serious felonies from the Earned Risk Reduction Program. And it included a number of various acts of sexual assault. I thought for sure that all the women on the Judiciary Committee would vote for that because over 1,000 rapists have been let loose from prison early in Connecticut because of this program. And I thought in these days of the Me Too movement and with the emphasis rightfully so on women who have been victimized by rapists and all sorts of sexual assault all these years, that there would be a universal support among the female legislators for saying, look it, you commit a crime like rape, you don't get out of jail early no matter what. You got to be behind bars and serve your full term. But not a single female Democrat voted for it. Every single female Republican did vote for it. And why a female legislator would not vote for this is beyond me in these days of Me Too.
Why was there any reason given by the female Democratic legislators to say they voted against this? Did they think there was some sort of a Republican poison pill in there, or what was their reasoning, if they gave any at all?
I have not heard any reasoning at all. When I testified in front of the legislature or in front of the Judiciary Committee about that bill, I was asked questions about it by a number of the female Democratic legislators on the committee. And I thought, that's good. They're asking questions. They're interested. They want to know about this. And one of the questions had to do, too, with, well, you know, would these people have committed the crime anyways? And I said, well, they might have. But, you know, my opinion is they're getting out of prison early and they're supposedly being rehabilitated when obviously they're not. I mean, someone who's in jail and let out early and then goes and sexually assaults a woman, it's ipso facto proof that they haven't been rehabilitated, that they're still dangerous and violent to the community. So I have not heard, it's just shocking to me that a single female Democrat supported that bill, and it went down. There was a committee vote on it. It went down straight party line, and not a single Democrat, male or female, voted for it. And it's just, to me, I don't understand it. I could understand, look, having a program to try and rehabilitate criminals, but letting them out of jail early is failing as an inducement for them to continue good behavior once they're outside of prison. It's a motivator only when they're in prison. But, you know, it goes without saying, Paul, that if the reward is given to you when you get out of prison, then it's not there any longer after you're on the street. And if that was the only reason why you behaved well in prison, it's no longer a factor when you're out of prison. So it's not a real it shows to me that they're not really being seriously rehabilitated. They're just going through the motions.
As we continue checking in with one of our regulars, former Republican state senator from Meriden, Len Susio, he's got an op-ed that I posted on our WICC 600 Facebook page talking about the ongoing controversy that some see in the state's early release program. And Len, an important point I wanted to touch back on here just for a moment. We're not saying, and you're not saying, that keeping these prisoners, these men and women in prison for their entire terms would have automatically rehabilitated them. But I think the common person would sit back and say, well, wait a minute. If they get out early and then they go and reoffend, Len, you know, there's always a chance, we don't know how big it is, but there's always a chance that had they not been on the street at that time, when they may still have been behind bars, that crime may have not occurred.
That's true. And again, Paul, think about it from the point of view of a woman who's been victimized by a rapist. She thinks her tormentor, the rapist, is behind bars for whatever, 15 years. Then she finds out he's getting out of jail years ahead of schedule. Now, think about, number one, the sense of betrayal, the sense of like, well, there's a lack of justice here. I've got to live with this rape for the rest of my life, and this guy's out of jail years ahead of schedule. And then think about the fear that woman has, too, because her testimony put this criminal behind bars, and now he's out early. And let's face it, I mean, I would be scared to death if my testimony put a violent criminal behind bars and now they're getting ahead of schedule. Would they come after me after that? I've been contacted by dozens of women over the last few years who have expressed that exact anxiety. Totally understandable. So it's a betrayal of, I think, of the sense of justice. It's a betrayal of the victims themselves, who now have anxiety once again because their tormentors are out. I think I told you once before in another interview, Paul, one of the women who approached me, her father was the one who raped her when she was 7 and 8 years old. And he was finally put in jail. She had called me 2 years ago because he was getting out of jail like 4 years ahead of schedule. And she was terrified. And, you know, think about this. It wasn't just a rapist. It was her father. Oh. I mean, to a child. And I think, what are the psychological implications of that? So it just, to me, it's every time a crime is being committed by one of these criminals, it's absolutely proof positive that they weren't reformed in their particular situation. And when you look at it and say, wow, with over 16,000 victims of violent crime, one murder or rape every 6 or 7 days, you would think, well, maybe that's proof enough that the program ought to be itself put on hold, reviewed and reformed. Maybe just keep it to violent, nonviolent criminals. I could see that.
Yeah.
And I've been told by DOC inmates, by the way, that the program is gamed all the time. There's a great book that's been written by a couple of inmates in Connecticut called Down the Rabbit Hole. You can get it on Amazon.
Okay.
You know, and it's a book that's written by them about the culture of corruption inside the DOC in Connecticut and how it actually reinforces criminal behavior rather than discourages criminal behavior. And I'm not saying it's infallible, it's the be all and end all, but it gives a completely different perspective on the prison system in Connecticut and how it really doesn't discourage criminal behavior. It actually rewards it and is an incentive for people. It reinforces the behavior, the criminal mindset to begin with. And it's very well written and extremely well documented by a couple of guys. And one of them, by the way, is a regular on another talk show in Connecticut. He actually is interviewed from his jail cell in prison. Yeah, I'm not kidding.
Yeah. And Len, so the way that this program is implemented, and one thing I think people may want clarification on, so When a, let's say you have a rapist or a violent crime, and the judge remands this rapist to jail and says, okay, it's a 15-year prison term, minimum 10 or 12 years served, you know, eligible for release after 12 years are served. Now, that early release, is that mandated by the presiding judge, Len, or is that early release something that's tacked onto by or from the Department of Corrections?
The early release program is separate from that.
Okay,
that's where again there's another interesting study. I could tell you it was published in the New York Times basically a few years ago.
Yep.
But something like 94% of all criminal cases are plea bargained down to a lesser penalty. So you're already starting out with a reduced penalty to begin with for the crime. Someone who's, let's say, guilty of first-degree aggravated sexual assault might plead guilty to first-degree assault, sexual assault, or you know. And again, the victims, you got to put yourself in the mind, in the shoes of the victims originally violated, and now, of course, the victims a second time around. And by the way, Paul, I'll just say one other thing.
Yeah.
When I cite these statistics, I'm talking about the inmates themselves. So when I say 16,000 violent crimes, there's one like Sergio Correa, who was accused last year of murdering three people, not one. I got him in my file once, and that's it. So I'm counting him only one time, even though he's been accused of three brutal murders.
Yeah.
So I'm actually understating, if anything, the number of crimes that are being committed. I'm just referring to the number of
Len,
criminals.
Len, in about the minute we have left, do you get people coming, telling you, you know, from, say, corrections, do you get people coming up to you, Len, or telling you an email, whatever, geez, just be quiet about this. You're killing us here. This is causing a big problem. I mean, what have you heard from inside about this?
Well, actually, the DOC officers themselves have supported me on this thing. Unfortunately, I can't talk any of them into coming out public because they're worried about losing their job.
Sure.
But I've been told by the correction officers themselves, parole officers, and by inmates, the system is not working. It's breaking down, and it's being gamed by the inmates.
Len, thank you. We appreciate it. If you want, if you can get any of these inmates or these officers, maybe if they want to do it anonymously, let me know. Maybe we can arrange something. Len Susio, Len, thanks. I appreciate it.
Paul, I'll definitely take you up on that. Let's have a private conversation, and I could put you in touch with a few people.
All right, Len, thanks. Appreciate it. We'll talk down the line, and have a happy Thanksgiving. We thank you, Len.
You too, Paul. I'm going out to get my turkey
now. Have mercy on it. Len Susio there, former Republican state senator. Couple of terms under his belt. He may run again. Who knows? But there you go, folks. He says he's got corrections officers and inmates themselves who say the whole thing's a joke. But we see in Connecticut, we can't fix anything. No, we got to just stay where you are. Don't move it. See, because again, if the inmates get out early, it's cheaper for the state, right?
You're listening to Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli on WICC 600.
And thanks for dropping by. We appreciate it. As we're in the 4 o'clock hour, another check of traffic and weather together coming up in less than 10 minutes right here on WICC 600. The number is always 203-333-9422, 333-WICC, and former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg jumping into the fray for the presidential campaign on the Democratic side, and he raised a few eyebrows, maybe not everyone's eyebrows, but Mr. Bloomberg a few days ago apologizing for a controversial tactic called stop and frisk that some say is vital and has worked to stop violent crime. Others saying it is racist and preys on people of color. We want to talk about that and more, how law enforcement's going to play out in the coming campaign with our guests. We've had him on here before. We welcome back Lance LaRusso, former law enforcement officer. He's the author of When Cops Kill and Blue News. He's also a leading attorney. You've seen him on Fox News, CNN, the Fox Business Network, all over. Lance, Paul here in Bridgeport again. How are you, sir? Thanks for coming back.
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Not too bad. Well, what did you think? Did you say I told you so or you thought so when Michael Bloomberg flip-flopped Stop and Frisk the other day, Lance, you know, a program that he kind of championed when he was mayor?
Well, it seems like a lot of people are on the apology tour these days, and the apology tour seems to center around apologizing for things that law enforcement officers do to keep people safe. You know, the whole stop and frisk issue, certainly a stop and frisk or any police procedure can be used in an improper manner, but the concept of stop and frisk is from a case from 1968 called Terry versus Ohio. There's absolutely no doubt that law enforcement officers who were trained, and the United States Supreme Court recognized in Graham versus Connor, that law enforcement officers understand things differently. They have different training than the average person. That a law enforcement officer watching someone for signs that they are carrying a weapon, just as one example, will look for telltale signs that are objective, that can be written down, that can be discussed in court. And a lot of times they are finding people who are involved in criminal activity based on those inquiries. So what we have essentially is a large amount of people, again, who don't understand police procedure and want to bash the police because it's easier than saying those horrible words in the English language, I don't know.
You know, at the end of that whole thing, Lance, when the de Blasio administration took over in New York and they did not follow up on an appeal, the city, as you well know, was going to file in the case of a judge who ordered that stopped or slowed down. I think in the previous couple of years of doing stop and frisk, they had pulled something close to 1,000 weapons, if I remember an op-ed from Ray Kelly there. They pulled, Lance, something close to 1,000 weapons off the streets of New York.
Well, there's always they say that politics makes for strange bedfellows. So if you think about this from a 10,000-foot view, you have Michael Bloomberg, and I don't know you can get anybody who is more anti-Second Amendment and anti-gun rights, who is now apologizing for a program that law enforcement was using, according to United States Supreme Court precedent, to remove firearms from people who were carrying them illegally or were involved in criminal acts. You couldn't make that up on a bet. There's a comedian in L.A. dying for a joke like that.
Also, somebody who obviously, Lance, is probably not going to go a lot further along in the campaign here, Kamala Harris, of course, a former prosecutor herself who, you know, has a reputation for being too ham-fisted. Some progressives say, you know, she's been on the bashing bandwagon as well.
Well, you know, law enforcement is a pretty easy group to bash, and I'll tell you why, and it's really kind of an interesting thing that a lot of people don't understand. It's not just law enforcement, but, you know, it's public employees in general. They can't fight back. A lot of times they are not permitted to have the frank, open discussions, especially when they're in uniform, that a lot of other private citizens are, or public sector employees who are, say, an elected employee. If you scream at them, if you step on their toes, a lot of times they can't even scream. Their First Amendment rights are limited in the course of their duties. Their First Amendment rights are limited in what they say and how they say it. So they're a pretty easy target to bash because a lot of them are unable to fight back, and a lot of the police chiefs or people in power are quite frankly fearful that if they do stand up for their officers, they risk retaliation and losing their jobs.
The role of police unions and public sector unions, Lance, in making endorsements or coming out in favor of one candidate or another. I saw there was one police union that came out and endorsed President Trump the other day for his second term. Do you think that's going to be as big this coming election cycle? Bigger? Are they going to be muzzled? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's kind of interesting to see what's going to happen in the next, you know, 6 to 9 months with this election. We have some unbelievable acts taking place right now in the Congress, and there's no telling where they're going to go. But I think from a perspective of law enforcement, they are just happy somebody's sticking up for them. And when you're looking at the daily bashing that they are taking, the daily abuse that is handed to the average law enforcement officer, never mind the fact that on average about a third of law enforcement officers are physically assaulted every year. You're talking about officers receiving the type of berating responses to, may I see your driver's license, that we've never seen before, and people are actually encouraging these types of confrontations with law enforcement. I think when it comes time to them to support a candidate, I think a lot of it has to do with who is supporting us.
You know, Lance, and the guest is Lance LaRusso. Lance, you know, the whole driver's license thing reminded me. I was on the internet one day, and I was, you know, just kind of bouncing around YouTube, and maybe because of my previous searches, I came around a bunch of videos there by these people called the Sovereign Citizens. Is that their name? And as you say, it's almost like they set up law enforcement to have a police officer say, okay, I see the camera, can I have your driver's license, please? And eventually they end up getting their window broken because they're idiots. I mean, do they think that this is going to get them anything? I mean, these Sovereign Citizen videos, I got to admit you, Lance, I was hooked. I was watching these things for like 2 hours. I couldn't believe this.
So I dealt with groups of people that claimed they were sovereign citizens in when I was a fraud investigator and when I was a prosecutor, and it's an interesting argument. Their argument is that the United States was bankrupt at the time of the 14th Amendment passing. So therefore, if they don't submit themselves to the state jurisdiction, that the federal jurisdiction does not apply to them. So federal courts have no jurisdiction over them, and that unless they're engaged in commercial activity, they cannot be regulated by any state or federal entity. Which is interesting. It sounds really good inside your head, I guess, to some folks, but not so much from out here. But I have seen these folks make just kind of entertaining arguments, and you see the confrontations, and at least one of those videos you're talking about came from Georgia.
Yeah.
But some of those folks, the more extreme folks, have actually attacked law enforcement officers.
Oh, they're crazy.
There were people that were
they're
claiming
nuts.
To be part of sovereign citizen movements that were responsible for murdering a couple of officers a few years ago.
You've seen our guest on CNN, the Fox News Channel. He's written the books When Cops Kill and Blue News. He's leading attorney, former law enforcement officer Lance LaRusso joins us for a few more minutes in a return visit here to WICC 600. Lance, I'm all for body cams, and we're getting more and more of those here in Connecticut. We just had a law passed by our General Assembly requiring the release of video of certain types of encounters with police within a certain amount of hours after a fatality or whatever, which is good. But the notion of people shooting their own video and using their phones, which are all around right now, what are your thoughts on that? And is that a real hindrance to police men and women, to law enforcement, Lance, that are trying to conduct a job out there, keeping an area safe when they've got people just shoving cameras in their faces?
Well, it does make it a little bit more difficult sometimes. It's extremely distracting, and distraction is not good when you're dealing with somebody who could be dangerous. But the problem with body cameras is they are never going to give you the officer's view of what happened. And the officer's view and their perception of what happened is what's important when you're evaluating their actions. So if you look at a body camera has no peripheral vision. A body camera does not move with the officer's eyes. It doesn't see the same way in low light and no light. And the body camera also does not focus on one thing, usually a suspected threat, to the exclusion of everything else.
Yeah.
So, for example, I've had officers who were staring at somebody's hands and had no idea whether the person was wearing shorts or pants. We've seen videos where officers were watching a suspect and had no idea that the suspect's mother was standing 2 or 3 feet to their right. They were so hyper-focused. Cameras don't do that. So when we take that camera even further, when we take the camera to a person standing across the street, there's a delay in how long it takes for sound to reach. There's a difference in the lighting from where that person's standing to where the officer is. There's a difference in what's heard and perceived, and there's a difference in the point of view. So the officer may not see something that a person 3 feet to the officer's right and 10 feet back would see on a video. And that's essentially one of the problems that you see when we look at a video. And then when you put that also in the concept of using appropriate force, mm-hmm. whether it's non-deadly force or deadly force, will never look good on camera. If I'm walking out of your studio and you grab me around the neck, it's not going to feel good for you. But if you watch that video and first you start the video when I strike you,
yeah.
I'll look like the aggressor. But even if you see the start of the situation, using force is never going to look good on video. So we have people who have no idea about the use of force, the laws of the use of force, the mechanics, and they're making judgment calls. So just one example, about 10, 12 years ago, people wanted to ban tasers.
Mm-hmm.
Tasers are terrible. They're going to electrocute people, even though they're powered by a 9-volt battery, and everybody in your audience has licked a 9-volt battery before.
Yeah.
If you have an older brother, you've done it more than once. So they wanted to get rid of tasers, and now when an officer uses deadly force, what do we hear? Well, why didn't they tase them? So this is what I talk about in Blue News and When Cops Kill. And as we said before, all the profits from those two books go to law enforcement charities. We've donated about $27,000 so far.
Lance, doesn't all of the, you know, when we hear about these encounters that don't end well and get dragged out in months of court litigation and sometimes settlements here, don't a lot of these, from your concern and from what other attorneys have told me, don't a lot of these simply begin with a suspect or a person that people want to put under arrest just not complying with what an officer says? Wouldn't that de-escalate, you think, a lot of what goes on?
Oh, absolutely. And there are people who are pressing those contacts so they can make a good video. They're pressing the contacts so they can sue the police. And you have no idea why the officer stopped you. My favorite on some of those videos, it's like, yeah, I don't know if your mom thinks you're smart, but no one else does. I'm not going to show you my driver's license until you tell me why you stopped me. Well, that's not what the law says.
Yeah, what, Lance, can you I've had arguments with dear friends of mine, and I'm saying, no, an officer is within his or her right to do that. Please explain that.
Well, and the bottom line is the officer can stop you even if you haven't committed a traffic violation. But that's not a reason for you to refuse to give your driver's license. So this is where these people who are convincing people to do this create a problem. The officer comes up because the car may fit the description that was involved in a burglary. So the officer comes up, hey, can I see your driver's license, proof of insurance, or I'm sorry to bother you, I got a question. Oh, well, I'm not giving you my driver's license. Call a supervisor. Well, I'm not going to call a supervisor. I have you stopped here. Well, I'm not going to show you my driver's license until you tell me why you stopped me. Well, now the officer, as a reasonable person, their suspicion level is going up. Even though this person in the driver's seat may just be trying to give the officer a hard time, any reasonable officer would be thinking, why is this person concealing their identity? And when we go even a step further and we look at these situations that have been pressed, because we hear so much about de-escalation, and, you know,
yeah,
de-escalation requires the cooperation of two people, the officer and the suspect. And if the other person doesn't want to de-escalate, there will be no de-escalation. And there was a study done of 700 shootings involving police over 90 different agencies. And in 36% of those shootings, they were actually determined, looking back on hindsight, to be suicide by cop. When they looked, the person was facing a divorce. They were facing termination. They'd gotten a TPO served on them. And that person actually was pressing the confrontation to get to deadly force. Now, here's what's scary. In only 8% of those calls was the officer dispatched to a suicide call. And in 50% of those calls, when they went back and asked family members and friends, the person had never verbalized any warnings that they were going to commit suicide. So now here's the disconnect. The officer responds, the suspect pushes the confrontation, there's deadly force used, and now people say, well, there were never any signs the person was dangerous. And now we have a cop who's indicted or a cop who is crucified in the media because of a lack of information.
The names of the books are When Cops Kill and Blue News, the proceeds of which, as he mentioned, go to charity. Our guest, once again, leading attorney, former law enforcement officer, Lance LaRusso. Lance, thank you. It's always a pleasure. Have a happy Thanksgiving and a good holiday season. We hope to have you back. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. Not easy to be a cop, folks. Not easy. I tell you, I have lawyer friends of mine who take cases against police officers, and one of them told me, I had a guy come in my office, and he said, look, here's a video, and my friend says to him, you got no case, and the guy goes, what are you talking about? He goes, the cop asked you like 5 times to put your hands behind your back. He goes, by the time you said no like the 3rd time, that kicked in a whole bunch of different things that he's allowed to do, so...
You're listening to Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli on WICC 600.
And that's us. Hey, how are you? It's 8 past 5 o'clock, fourth and final hour of our Monday get-together here on Thanksgiving week 2019. This is Connecticut Today. We're 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Well, you remember we started out with no tolls here in Connecticut. Then we went to tolls on the trucks only. Then we said, screw that, we're going to trucks and cars. And now we said, screw that, we're going back to trucks only. Who knows what's coming up further, but to talk about this, gentleman I've talked to a couple of times over the years, concerned with trucks, the Motor Transport Association is. That's the organization that represents Connecticut's truckers, big and small, and the head of the Motor Transport Association, Joe Scully, back with us on WICC. Joe, how are you today?
I'm all right. Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Joe, good to talk to you again. I talked to you months ago, and we were at trucks only, and then we went to cars and trucks, and now we're back to trucks only. And, Joe, you folks in the Motor Transport Association, all the big and small truckers here in the state, you must feel like a political ping pong ball at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. MTAC, we represent mostly small business trucking companies located here in the state of Connecticut. We pay, members pay all the taxes and fees that they are owed. The state has a history, unfortunately, of not using that money wisely. And then the state government comes back and says to the members that have paid all the taxes and fees that they should, that they got to pay more. They're sick of it. They're furious. They're just trying to fight for every dollar that they can, and they employ people who make a good living, and they just don't understand it, and neither do I. What did small business trucking companies do? Nothing. We're just trying to help the economy here.
Yeah, Joe, let's backtrack here for a moment. You said you represent the small and medium-sized truckers here in Connecticut, so I would imagine that you've got members of the Motor Transport Association from what, single owners, single trucks, maybe up to mid-sized local companies with a small fleet, correct?
Oh, absolutely. We've got a few what we call owner operators. It's one guy or one gal in one truck. We've got a few of those type of members, and most of our members anywhere from, let's say, three trucks to 15 to 25 to 35 is where most of our folks fall. I would tell you the biggest Connecticut-based trucking company in terms of fleet size is 250 trucks. That's impressive. I'm very proud of this company. But if you go to a state like Arkansas or Iowa, 250 trucks doesn't get you anywhere near the top. It's just a different situation up here.
Now, Joe, a couple of things. First, let's start with the fact that, people, part of the talking point, and you've probably heard this ad nauseum from people when you're up at the Capitol lobbying, those trucks, they don't pay any money toward the roads. Look at the destruction they're doing to 95 and 91 and 84 and Route 9, and they're getting away scot-free with it. How does the money break down here, Scott and Joe, I'm sorry, and what's your reaction to that?
Well, I would tell you a couple things, and I want to focus on out-of-state trucks specifically for
sure.
a second,
yep.
because that's what we keep hearing about. Out-of-state trucks come through for free. That's the claim. That's not true at all. The state gets about $25 to $30 million annually from out-of-state trucks because there are a couple of systems in place that allow us to collect diesel taxes on the diesel that is used in the state by these out-of-state trucks. And there's a similar system for the registration fee side. Again, $30 million annually. This is just out-of-state trucks. And unfortunately, there are people making a claim otherwise, even though they know it's not true, which is very frustrating to me. I have to tell the truth and be honest in order to be respected and credible, but it seems like it doesn't go the other way sometimes.
So they're using that then when you're saying they know that, okay, we may not get a huge amount of money, but these other trucks that come in from other states are in some way generating revenue, and you're saying that's not put out there.
Yeah, exactly. And look, since we're talking about truck-only tolls, mm-hmm. I saw a bit of info the other day, which I find very interesting. The state of Rhode Island, right, they're the ones who started the truck-only toll thing, which is still tied up in federal court and could be for a long time. They put in their budget this year, they thought they would get $25 million in tolls from trucks. Now, I just said that we already get $30 million annually from out-of-state trucks, and we don't even have tolls. Just think about that. Tolls are so wasteful. It costs about $2 million to put up one gantry. Are you telling me we're gonna spend $2 million times 12 or whatever the state is talking about now and only collect tolls from just trucks and that's it, only 5% of the population on the road? I just don't see it. I think this whole thing is about getting the gantries up. That's the hardest part of this. And then let's say the trucking industry wins its lawsuit in Rhode Island. That would mean that we can't do that here. And then we've got to toll cars. Well, the gantries are already up, so I guess we've got to toll cars. I think that's part of the play here.
And, Joe, on that Rhode Island case, that is interesting because there is, as you mentioned, right, there is a legal challenge at the federal level here that I know that's been bounced around as to whether or not it's even legal to toll just only trucks, correct?
Yeah, exactly. Our industry certainly believes that it discriminates against interstate commerce for a couple reasons, one being that, it's only trucks and a truck is commerce. Now, they've also got other aspects of the Rhode Island law that our industry is challenging, one being that no matter how many times you would pass under one gantry per day, you would only be charged once. So if you go under the same gantry, 10 times in a day, you would only be charged once. That's, I believe, in the governor's plan.
Yes, yes, it is.
And for what it's worth, we're suing over that in Rhode Island. So I think there are legal questions on that plan, too, let alone House Democrats' truck-only tolls plan. There's just a lot of – it's a very complicated issue that tries to get boiled down to tolls and targeting trucks as a part of that.
Talking about tolls and trucks with Joe Scully from the Motor Transport Association of Connecticut. We started off, you remember, a couple of years ago with the idea of tolling trucks only. Then we went to trucks and cars, and now the governor's latest proposal is trucks only again. They're in the middle of a big legal morass in Rhode Island with that as well. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Joe, I don't know if there's a typical example, but what the taxes, fees, user fees, diesel taxes, things like that, how much of a contribution do Connecticut's truckers, Joe, already make to the state economy as they're doing their daily business out on the major highways?
Sure, yeah, we do have some industry average numbers, and the one that stands out the most to me is $17,000. Now, that is the amount of, I call them road taxes, some people call them highway user fees, but let's say $17,000 in road taxes annually. That's the average for one 18-wheel tractor trailer. And some of those taxes are state diesel tax, federal diesel tax, registration fees, and here's some other ones. Federal excise tax, heavy vehicle use tax, and tire tax. Those are all taxes that only apply to commercial trucks. Passenger car drivers and owners and operators don't pay them. And so I think that may be part of the issue, right? And it makes sense. If you're not paying a tax, you may not know about it. Probably the only people that know about those taxes are people who work in the trucking industry.
Oh, sure. The people that have to write out the checks for them. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And so, if some people may think, well, geez, we got to make the trucks pay more, it's like, well, please hold on a second. Listen to these things that we're already paying that you may not know about. And by the way, that tax money, that's money going to the government for our roads. So we are paying our user fees, to use that word. And that's a ton of operating cost that we've got to make up in the form of charges to trucking industry customers.
Joe, we just had a listener call in, a commercial trucker owns a company, and this listener asked, about the ongoing impact that diesel fuel prices have here in Connecticut, in particular our fuel taxes here in the state, which, as you know, are some of the highest. I know it varies back and forth, but we pay some of the highest fuel taxes in the state here. How are those affecting your members, and are you hearing of, Joe, of any give and take here? I mean, I know up there some of the Democrats have said, well, if you give us tolls, we'll knock a penny or two over the off of the fuel taxes here. Talk about the impact that diesel has on your business.
Sure. So this caller, if they're in the industry, probably knows that diesel, the cost of diesel is either the first or second, you know, depending on the year or depending on the company, the first or second biggest cost for a trucking company. It's diesel fuel and it's payroll, paying salary to your employees. Those are the two most expensive things for a trucking company. When diesel rises, it can have dire implications, quite honestly. If you're in a contract to haul freight and you can't adjust, you can't raise your prices, that money's coming out of your pocket. Now, I want to talk about, and this may be a bigger discussion for another day, but there's an initiative out there called the Transportation Climate Initiative,
okay,
which is a regional gas tax. That's going to...
Oh, yes. Joe, I've talked about that on my show a lot of times. Yeah, yeah.
That's going to send the cost of diesel through the roof, which is going to, again, punish small business. It's going to make everybody pay more when they go to the grocery store and the department store. That's going to have a huge impact. And are we talking about tolls at the same time? I truly feel bad for these small businesses who just kept getting hit and hit and hit, and it never ends.
Joe, what about the argument that you're hearing from some, and I know you hear it, but I'll bring it up here again, that, well, we understand that you folks in the trucking industry, you know, you're valuable people. We understand you work hard. We understand you pay your tolls and fees, but your vehicles are so much heavier, so much bigger that, you know, you should pay more because you're banging up the roads more and causing all these potholes and these bridges to carry your way. What's your answer to those people, Joe?
Well, I would say, one, we already do, and I mentioned some average data that a great group called the American Transportation Research Institute puts out there. The trucking industry in Connecticut pays 32% of all road taxes, like registration fees and gas taxes, mm-hmm. like I mentioned, even though we're only 5% of the miles. So we're paying many times our fair share. Secondly, if you want to talk about weight and impact on the road, I would tell you this, and this might be another thing that people don't know unless they're in the industry. There's something called the Federal Bridge Formula. It's in federal law, and it has very specific things as far as what the gross weight of a truck is.
Yeah.
Has to be over a certain number of axles, and the axles have to be spaced appropriately apart, and the whole tractor-trailer combination has to be a certain length.
Which is why the gross vehicle weights are stenciled on the side of the cabs and the trailers, correct?
Absolutely. You're right on the money. And so if you comply with those things, and by the way, compliance is checked at way stations and random roadside inspections, you cannot inherently damage a road or a bridge. I think it would be ridiculous to say that we're building these highways yet we're not building them to a strong enough standard that can handle the trucks that we know are on it. It's just not true. There's no number. There's no proof as far as a truck does X percentage or X amount more damage than a car. It's just
interesting because that's what we're getting. I've had so many guests on who say, well, you know, they keep talking about the impact physically that a truck has on roads, but you're saying if the weight, and Joe, correct me if I'm wrong, but are you saying if the weight is distributed by federal guidelines, there's really no great impact?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, why would the federal government, if you think about it, why would the federal government have a subpar standard? Why would the state of Connecticut build and design to a subpar standard? It just doesn't make any sense if you want to think about it on a simple sort of level that way. And I'll just give you one more number.
Sure.
Here. It's a very small percentage of trucks that are overweight in Connecticut. It's 1.87%. That's so small that, again, I think we're talking about a problem that doesn't exist, or at least that hasn't proven to exist. So let's stick to the real facts that we have here.
Joe, thank you. Some very interesting numbers, and that's why I wanted to have you on today, because I know that you would bring some numbers to the table that we frankly don't hear about. The website MTAC, that's .us. Once again, MTAC.us, the Motor Transport Association of Connecticut. If you're a trucker, check it out. Go, Joe Scully, thanks so much, man. We appreciate it. Happy Thanksgiving, and we'll talk down the line. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks for having me. Happy Thanksgiving.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. Well, there you go, folks. See, now I didn't know that truckers are responsible for a very small amount of the total miles driven in the state versus cars, and they say they pay their fair share. Interesting stuff here. Just trying to open your eyes here, not telling you which way to think about it, though.